Succession, number 30059, reel number 8.
So the day after that, as they moved in, as they were supposed to, in the second day. In other words, come in and actually lay a carpet of them right in front of them. I don't mean a quarter of a mile. I mean 100 yards or so in front, just like artillery, because there wasn't any artillery going to be available to any amount. But we had to be the air artillery to figure out the thing. We figured it out. And the B-17s literally laid down carcass of bombs. It's generally known. It's one of the things that was only spoken of in one of the, in my libraries down here, it's in Arkansas, but in one of the books, and I've forgotten which one it was, is the only time that it spoke extensively about this carpet bombing under the U.S. ground. You will have uncovered that. That was our, one of our projects. See how varied the projects were?
Yeah. How did you achieve that? What was the...
Well, in the first place, it was all... We figured out mathematically how the airplane should be spaced. We figured out mathematically exactly what the release time should be. We picked crews that this was going to be a small force. It wasn't a tremendous, you know, it was a force of 100 airplanes, I believe. We picked the top navigator, bombardier, picked the top pilots, the top everything, and trained them in separately to do this particular job. And they did a mega, only one squadron, let us bombs go prematurely, and it did kill some American troops. But compared to, you know, these things are comparative anyway, compared to the slaughter that there might have been from an operation like that, it was nothing. And compared to the losses there might have been had we not laid down this carpet of bomb, or it was a really fine
operation. High altitude?
20,000 people. It was a very successful operation.
Was that over a several-day period or a week?
3 days in a row. And it began, well, the first operation actually done on D+1. They hadn't moved in very far, as you know, just barely in. But they were beginning to consolidate their forces on the beachheads. And, of course, by this time, the coastal defenses had been overrun. And they were now then meeting the German, what, the 7th Army? It was in that part of...
I think so.
Well, whatever it was, anyway. They ran all the way from the Côte d'Ivoire Peninsula all the way up to where the British went in. Operation Sword was it was the 82nd that dropped in right in the middle of this group in the Cherbourg Peninsula. See, they put in on D+1, 2, and 3. And of course, another thing that we coordinated, part of the job was a laying out a communications plan that involved getting communication from the ground, from a given spot on the ground, through the radio network, through a half a dozen different relay stations, back to the units when they were just approaching the area where the troops were. You couldn't say on a map, well, this is what we'll do tomorrow.
No.
You know where they'd move, how far they'd move, that, and how what they were doing a half an hour before you were going to lay it down. And, of course, in the communications back, we are now so-and-so, and our bombs now, our plan is to release them at such and such a point, and they will fall so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. And if they had advanced beyond that point, because there was a point of no return, obviously, it took a little while to put the data in the bomb sites and a few other things. And so there was a point at which the communications had to be all back, you know, stand back, stand well clear, because we're going to bomb so-and-so and so-and-so on the coordinates, the grids that we had worked out. And it was a very successful operation. Well, I think the air artillery, I think they would call it, if I'm not mistaken. But that just showed you the gamut of things that if we were called on to do this. We want to do Doolittle's plans. And they said to Doolittle, somebody said, Doolittle, you got to help us with bombardment because we can't get any big guns ashore enough quantity. The Navy were firing, of course, still in the channel and firing the big guns. But compared to what we had to have, it laid a carpet so as to destroy not mass large areas that the naval guns were doing, but to actually just like you've got a brush fire, that brush on front of the advancing troops and move it along like this. And that's what we were doing. They were moving along directly back of the bomb line as each individual unit dropped. They were moving back of the bomb line, back with the bomb line, mm-hmm. just the way you do with artillery mm-hmm. in the field.
Was this once a day for 3 days? Or
several,
was it several?
It was several times, several sorties, because mm-hmm. the distances were short. Mm-hmm. And we were an old fighter opposition. We had fighter cover. I know I flew in the first, I flew fighter cover to observe this thing. Once we lighted, I kind of wanted to see how well we'd done.
Of course.
And they wouldn't let me fly in the B-17s. They had all these picked personnel, and they said, you'd just be in the way. I agreed that was probably the case. And so I said to them, how about letting me fly along with the fighter escort? And Doolittle said, okay, you do that. So I did. Ben and I both did and watched. Another thing that to show you again, how Perry, Doolittle came out to the aerodrome one day. And I'm taking up too much of your tape. It's a good bull session. That's why I haven't used in a long time.
I have more tape in the car.
Good listener.
I have more tape in the car.
Called and said, I'm coming out. I want to visit with you about something. And Ben was just ready to go back to the States. This was in about D plus, I don't know, maybe D plus 30. He came out and he had a map. He unfolded very carefully and he said, you see this island here? And I said, yes, Ben said, yes, we see it. He said, you do see what you can do about that island. And Ben said, what do you mean do about that island? And he said, you know, the Germans have fortified that island. They have 7-8-inch naval rifles cut right into the, they cut tunnels in this rock. And they're anywhere from 10 to 12 feet underground. And the Doolittle said there have been X thousand tons of bombs dropped on. You could see it. Just one crater on top of another, practically. But he said it didn't do any good because everything is way down underground. He said they're controlling all of the shipping from Mont Saint-Michel all the way over to Cherbourg Harbor. And we wanted the shipment to go by there bad. We were to get supplies into the troops. This was a matter of just a little while after D-Day. And he said, go take a ride and see what you can find out. And I said, I'd like to go too, but he said, they won't let me. So Ben and I took off. And we never, maybe a half an hour later, left of this particular island, Cezanne. And we circled it kind of warily because all the intelligence on it, not only did they have a lot of fine anti-aircraft, but a lot of fine gunners manning that anti-aircraft. So we got down on the water, literally, circled around, got a couple of dogs kind of going around, and kept looking at each other. And I can hear Ben now saying, what do you think we better do? I said, oh, I don't know, Ben, what we ought to do, but I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to fire a couple of rounds right into one of those casemates, just for fun, just to see if the guns work. Well, I did. And in a matter of, well, we were halfway around the island, coming back like that, they're running out of the top of the island, waving a white flag. And Ben said, you see what I see? And I said, yeah, I see what you see. Do you see what I see? He said, yes, I see what you see. I said, no, you don't see what I see, because what I see is how the hell are we going to take, accept the surrender of this goddamn island sitting up here in these P-38s? He said, that's your problem. No, it isn't my problem. It's, we're going to get credit for this island. It was the last thing in the world that I knew because they surrendered to us. So I got on the horn and down through the radio chain and it got to the to whatever the troops were on. I forgot. I think it was still remnants of the 82nd, one of the infantry divisions here. And they put boats out while we were circling. And I said, lean the engines way back. They will just stay here until they go. The damn well see them. And come, they took them and they accepted the surrender. We got credit for the island and it's in the history books. This island surrendered to the Ben Kelsey and Cass Huff.
Are you the only two men that shot down an island?
P-38.
Did you get to paint an island on the P-38?
No, Doolittle said to me long after that, he said, I didn't send you out there to get the island to surrender to. I just wanted to find out how we could get it to surrender. I said, well, you said, you want to find out how the island get the island to surrender? So we figured it out on the spot. Small job, neatly done.
I love that. Did the Germans ever say why they surrendered so readily?
Well, they said that they one man who on interrogation, who was a commanding officer, is reported to have said, I have not seen the testimony, but I got a third or fourth hand through the intelligence section. Because I made the same inquiry, and I'm sure that they were asked this question about why they came to surrender. They had ammunition like you wouldn't believe it, still left in there. And they said that they were afraid that we had found the secret of what to do. They said, as long as the people dropped bombs on them, they knew they were safe. But the minute they began coming right at them, they say he put his hands up, and we were coming right in, like looking right in these casemates. And I knew they couldn't. They had big guns and they were going to fire at us. The chance of hitting us was small. Because they hit us and we never know what hit them. Anyway, these 8-inch shells. But they said the minute we saw those guns fire and a couple of the tracers come in the casemate, we knew that they had a good chance of hitting our magazines and we'd all be blown to pieces. So we decided it was a good time to surrender. Hmm.
Smart man.
Because it was a good time, because we would have just kept doing that until we did get a magazine. I can see that man sat on the top of that island waving that white flag. Man, I said, what the hell do we do now? So it wasn't all hard work. It was, some of it was fun, too. Most of it was fun.
Well, that's fun.
Most of it was fun.
Most of it.
Yeah, most of it was fun. Whatever, all the kinds of experiences like that. Well, I can't think of so many of them, but every day of Lord, it's... And one of the many nice things about this particular job and this particular operational engineering group that I had was that every day was a different problem. And one that nearly every day, a problem that in most instances had a direct bearing on something that might happen. We were in most instances, a good many instances, at least in advance of what was going to happen. We were like with the Disney bombs. This was something that was an advanced stage of warfare, something that had never been done before. And so many things that we did had never been done. The groups knew them, the piggyback P-38 and the tanks for the P-47 and all these things that we did were all things that it wasn't like the drudgery of a desk job or everyday combat job, which wasn't good. Solve some of these problems that we had. And another nice thing about it was a constant parade by permission from Doolittle of bigwigs from States and from the British, sometimes the French, the Free French, other quote allies, into our outfit to just see how we were able to accomplish. Doolittle would brag about it. Hunter did it, and so did Kettner, and so did Doolittle. Would brag, and maybe were a drink or two, about this wonderful little outfit I've got out here at Bobbington, and tell them some of the things I've done. The next thing you know, they'd want to come talk to us. Well, when they were given permission to come talk to us, we were always told what we could talk about. But I insisted on that. I said, it's got to be in paper. And particularly what we can't talk about, because it's pretty hard to isolate things in a workshop or in a hangar or on an airplane or whatever. You know, the secret here, and this is just a routine sort of a maintenance thing over here. So we finally got so that when this parade began from Wright Field and from Washington Air Force headquarters and from, let's say, the French and the British and the Navy and all the others, and to see what we were doing and how we did it, we finally got so that we had got curtains in the hangar on certain, we moved our secret project, but that, there was danger in that too, that it would give away. One of the nice things, the way we did things before we got this parade of people, was that anybody who was just trying to spy on us, and I'm sure there were people, didn't know what the hell we were doing. Here sits an airplane, and it could be amount to nothing, but an operational airplane, and here sits one that could be very super secret something or other, and he wouldn't know the difference. But the minute you began to hang cloths up around something, it told them where to look. And so we had a couple of falsies hung up there, too. We had to, because we had to protect what we were doing for many of reasons. I didn't want my people to get bombed. I didn't want to, we were bombed a couple of times, and sure. I'm of the opinion that it was because intelligence, the German intelligence, got word that a lot of things were going on in our little station there. We weren't bombed very heavily. They did a pretty poor job, thank God. We missed us by a couple hundred yards. And shook us and knocked the hangar down, an old beat-up hangar that we had in the back. Other than that, it was all. And a buzz bomb busted, landed right in the middle of the aerodrome one day. That was only, of course, by accident. They couldn't control the fact that it was close. And our runways were not operational for a couple of days. But that's a close thing. We tried to get good security on that place, but not ostentatious security. That's the thing I didn't want. I usually used to say to me every now and then, or other people, Google understood, other people said, I don't see any armed guards running around there. That's the worst thing in the world could happen to us. Because it is, nobody knows where the meat of this thing is. Some that's up here, some that's in that guy's head, some that's on paper, some that's out in the shop out here.
Was everyone aware in the Air Force, pretty much, what you all were up to?
No.
Just high command?
Maybe that was a too quick an answer. I think they were aware of the fact that we were doing a lot of special things, but how top secret, how well classified they were, I don't think too many of them knew. The word began to get around, and I'd meet somebody in a pub someplace, I'd introduce myself, and he'd introduce himself, and then he'd say, Huff, are you, where are you? And I'd say, out at Bobbington. Oh, out at Bobbington. Oh, yeah, out at Bobbington. What are you boys doing out there? It was a classical conversation. We're just bending tin flying a few airplanes, trying to make them fly better, and a few things like that. Oh, but you're doing other things, aren't you? We got another job. We didn't try to slough it off as best we could.
Maybe most of the units thought you were just mostly solving their problems.
Well, that's what we wanted to think. Yeah. Anyway, actually, we had a half a dozen people in the outfit who were spending their time just solving more or less routine, all running the gamut of things. Looking at this January 27th, for example, installation of a magneto cooling blast tube, rework of a filter cap to eliminate failure of oil filter tube by localizing the failure and replaceable cap, and all things like that that were just two or three people with little things they were working on. There were two secret projects, small secret out there. Enforced air cooling with caliper 50 barrels to increase their life. Modification of coolant, automatic temperature control to ensure positive operation. These were, kind of run-of-mind things, but the real secret thing never got put on these sheets. If they did, they were simply marked secret, so we'd have a record of the fact that there was a project going on, and then we'd have to look in the secret file in the highly classified material to see what we were doing. There's several on here that are marked secret, and I don't know now without looking at the file what they were at the time, but there were a number of them.
Interesting. Oh, right field. Go over what you were talking about with Wright Patterson. That's 22. We were talking about that.
Of course, I think I covered that.
Well, we were talking about that before we were taping. We were just sitting out in the living room talking about that Wright and Patterson were two separate.
Well, Patterson Field, before and during World War II, Patterson Field was simply a maintenance base. Nothing else. Wright Field was where the think tank was, and they're the ones that took umbrage at what we were doing, and Roger's right in saying Wright Field. I said that Wright Field. Well, Wright Field to me meant all the people there, and I would say that in all probability most of them felt the way that the commanding general felt. It's almost by osmosis, You wear the same uniform and you think the same way, or you get transferred. I think they were jealous of their position. They had enough to do. They didn't understand some of our problems. I'm sure that if they did understand them, and if they'd given the almost carte blanche that we had, that they would have done maybe even a better job than we did. But the fact is, we were there. And we had people who were operational people that knew what the problems were and were able to, in most instances, to cope with them. And the Wright Field gave us a hard time. Wright Field tried to put us out of business several times. They told General Arnold, so I'm told, that we were usurping their, that how could, we were undercutting them, that we were ruining their efforts, that we were ruining some of the airplanes. Some of the things we recommended and done were absolutely inimical to the best interests of the Air Force and so forth and so on, all of which was a bunch of malarkey. It was just a method of trying to get General Arnold to finally tell Doolittle to close us down or to send us to the service command or something. One time they wanted my whole outfit sent back to the States. Said, if you're so good at this thing and so important, then we want you back here. And that was just another ploy. And Doolittle just, as I understand, just laughed at me and said, ho, no chance. And I understand he said once, if they're going to take you out of the theater, I'm going to transfer you all back to operational units. And then I'll just pick your brains at the long distance instead of having you back in the States. So they didn't fool with Doolittle much. He had an answer for everything they tried to do. But they I guess maybe they were jealous. I don't know, difficulties. We couldn't get anything out of that. If we wanted a simple little part, let's say, that we wanted to find out the trouble areas that we wanted to get a part from Wright Field we could work on, or find out what they had done about something so that we might find out if we were going to go up a blind alley, which is quite possible. Mm-hmm. They had already done a lot of things that we were going to do, and I'm sure we duplicated a number of things that they did with and came to the same conclusion. But to try to get them to tell us, no way. It was either no answer at all, or found out for yourself, but it's none of your goddamn business. Almost always. And there were a few people who had been right field trained, who were in the theater, that understood what we were trying to do, and I think probably sympathized with our position, kind of on the firing line between Doolittle and right field, had an opportunity to see firsthand that while we maybe were a little crude here and there, and God knows we were, we did the best we could with what we had, that we did get results in most instances, some, most of them good, some of them not so good, and that Doolittle had complete faith in us, and the operational units had complete faith in us, which was an important thing at that stage in time when losses were high and material was coming from the States, and tactics, training with people, all these things, that we had a kind of an aura in. Confidence in material was low. Morale was not the best it might be because of problems, mechanical and otherwise. And the fact that the operational units knew the people in, they knew me, they knew the people in our units, most of us anyway, and had confidence in what they were doing, went a long way, sort of holding their hands, whether we did a good job or not. You know, the fact that they thought that somebody could cry on the shoulder would be a help to them. So Howard Bunker was one who I think understood some of our problems. Mark Bradley, who was kind of the daddy of the P-47, the way Ben Kelsey was the daddy of the P-38. When Mark Bradley came to the UK, he brought too much of right field with him. Ben Kelsey, quite the different, quite opposite. Ben was an improviser, too. That's the reason we did so well together as a team. Ben was the trained aeronautical engineer. I was the untrained one, half-ass engineer, whatever you want to call it. And between us, the fact that Ben wasn't there very much of the time, but he was there enough to show me, for example, well, maybe I was going wrong on something. This is not a good engineering principle, or this is what I think would be a good idea. And he'd be gone for weeks, something, back to the States. It was Ben's guidance in many instances that made our projects, after he took over the command of the outfit, part of the time, anyway, I really was in command most of the time because Ben wasn't there most of the time. But he was there enough to say to me, this is a good project, and I think you ought to continue it, and if I were you, why don't you try so-and-so and so-and-so, or what are you going to planning to do? And he looked over and said, this is a good approach, or it's a bum approach. And why? It's a nice thing about Ben. Why? He didn't say it's a bum approach, period. He said, this is a bad approach. Why? And Doolittle had confidence in us. The operational units had confidence in us. We were characterized as spoiled brats, which maybe we were.
Maybe rightly so.
The fact remains that we had a pretty good record. Sure, I guess we were, in some instances, were a little snide in some of our replies to some of the service people and others, and the word got out that we were a bunch of bastards to the first degree. Don't tamper with them because they're Doolittle's babies. That was the kind of the consensus of the zone of the interior personnel, not the combat zone personnel. The English liked us. We helped their AFDU, their Air Fighting Development Unit in Duxford, where I went up to run tests with a P-38 against the Spit and the Hurricane and the German captured German fighters. I learned to respect to Campbell Ord, who ran the place, and Ted Smith, who was his assistant. when I flew with the airplanes against. I learned to respect them and what they were doing, and they in turn came to respect what we were able to do. And we traded information back and forth. People from Boscombe Down and Farnborough came to our place often, and we to their place, and we were always given an open sesame whenever we went there looking for information. It was an ideal kind of a wartime relationship. Cut all the corners if you can safely. Let nothing stand in your way, no matter who it is. Nothing or no person stand in your way. If you think you're right, you know, damn the torpedoes and full speed ahead, sort of thing. And I suppose that we did get a reputation for being able to do just that, to ride over people. But it didn't make any difference. We had a dedicated group of people, and they took some awful abuse sometimes from other people. I didn't, because I wouldn't stand for it. I'd walk away, or I'd reply in kind. But some of the junior officers found it kind of hard sometimes to take some of the crap they had to take from other people, and I felt sorry for them. I used to lecture them every now and then and tell them to just forget, you know, they're getting their dander up, and remember that we had a job to do, and that we had been reasonably successful. And until we came a real bad cropper two or three times in a row, not to worry about what people said to us and about us. It was an experience. The right field were little or no help to us. Right? Maybe that summarizes the whole thing.
I think you covered a great deal of 23.
Yes, and 24 as well. We had everything in the world. British as American fighters and bombers on the field assigned to us, and they'd be there for as long as we needed them. The British asked us to do I forgot exactly what the job was, on a mosquito. I had a mosquito there for several weeks trying to get somebody to show me the taps on it, but I don't want to fly it. Finally, after about a week or 10 days, nobody bothered to come around. Well, I took that out the handbook and read it, and away we went. And this great airplane, man, what the hell, they want us to do something that they felt they couldn't get done. But there was a mosquito out there not far from us. They sent the machine over. B-24s, B-17s, B-38s, B-47s, B-51s, Spitfires, B-26. One B-25, why I don't know, belonged to, being operated by some brass and USAF. And we finally left it there when we went back to the States, and we just took it over. Like the B-17 that I brought back to the States was a war worry that was sent down to us that we could have as a kind of a hangar queen.